This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us as we discuss the important events of this week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
On last week's program, we discussed the public backlash in America over authorities detaining immigrants, especially separating parents from children. We also talked about how Europe is dealing with similar questions and the way they're handling it. In some ways, it's far more severe. Yesterday, a major meeting was held among European leaders to deal with this issue. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, EU leaders are trying to come up with a solution. And they have one, they say, now, for migration. What they've come up with is this solution to host migrant detention centers, migrant camps, where they'd be able to put all these migrants in one place. Then they'll be processed. The ones that have to go home will go home. The few that they decide to allow into Europe will then be allowed to come into Europe. That's the broad picture. The trouble is they've agreed on this broad picture. They haven't agreed on the details, things like where are these centers going to be set up? They've said, oh, it's going to be based on mutual agreement. A lot of Europe has talked about these have to be set up in Africa. Others want them set up in Europe. So this is not yet a done deal. And as usual with Europe, but I think it's very interesting the direction they're moving into. A lot of people very keen on moving these detention centers into Europe. Another important event from just over the last day or two that I think is in some ways it's meant to be completely coincidental, but I think it's closely related, is that yesterday Libya's government expanded the area of the sea around Libya that they're kind of patrolling for migrants. So this makes a big change because if they catch a migrant, the Libyan Coast Guard catch a migrant, it goes back to Libya. In this area that is now dramatically expanded, it used to be that other navies would pick them up and take them to Italy or take them to Spain. So you're getting now this almost Europe extending its borders into North Africa. I think that's the big trend here. They're looking at setting up camps. They're looking at beefing up their border force. They're working with the Libyan Coast Guard and some of these other coast guards almost as kind of clients of Europe. And they're making sure that the migrants stay in North Africa. And really with both the stories that we're going to talk about for Europe this week, for the migrants in North Africa, and we'll talk a bit about the Balkans later on. You know, they're both kind of, you know, they can be seen very detailed and you know, the Balkans not necessarily very interesting. If you look at the big picture, it reminds me of kind of the latter half of the Roman Republic, where you've got this growing power that controls a lot of the Mediterranean, but not all of it. And it just realizes those places that it doesn't control causes it problems. And so for the Roman Republic, it led to this expansion where it just kept filling up those empty spaces to make sure that they would stop having problems. You'd have a king from the northern Black Sea region come and take over Greece and Italy and cause you major problems. You have to invade there. You know, you have various different points. You have to invade there. And that's what Europe's doing right now. I think when you look at it that way, it's very clear that they're in this almost rising empire type of phase. And okay, migrants are causing them problems in North Africa. We have to get more involved there. We have to start building camps there instead of Europe. We have to start working with African countries, training their militaries so that the migrants stay there and not coming into Europe. In the Balkans, we have an empty space. We have to move into there more to stop other countries doing that. So you've got this Europe that's really focused now, I think, on cementing its control all the way around the Mediterranean.
Well, that's a fascinating historical allusion that you're talking about, the connection with the Roman Republic. Would you mind just putting this in context, say, what they agreed to this week in setting up these detention camps. And what we talked about last week and the article that you put up on the website this past week, the title of the article, Who Really Locks Migrants in Concentration Camps? And you were talking about some of these very facilities already existing. What was it that they agreed to say that would be different or in addition to what they're already doing?
Well, again, it's because they haven't finalized the details and they've only agreed a broad outline, it's harder to get into those specifics. They're calling them disembarkation centers. And so the idea behind it is that, I guess, when you rescue migrants, you don't take them into Italy and just let them loose, where hundreds of migrants then wander around Italy. Some go on to Germany, some go on to France. You just take them all to a specific center. You put them in a camp and you deal with everything there. There's still a lot of argument about where these camps will be located. That's kind of, I think, where they've brushed that disagreement under the carpet so that they can have some kind of appearance of unity now. Europe has talked about, or Italy and some of these, like Hungary, some of these more anti-migrant countries have talked about camps in Libya, which would be a little problematic with international law, but Tunisia, some of these other centers, so that you rescue migrants, they get taken to Tunisia, their camp is in Tunisia, they're not in Europe, even if they escape from their camp, they're kind of back to square one, and then they say, okay, and then we'll take a handful of migrants from those camps. I think some of the other countries are more, they don't like that as much. But, and Tunisia, Libya, some of they're making some noises like, well, we won't accept this. They will for the right price. But that, I think, in terms of the details and the practicality, I think what we're looking at, they've still got more meetings to go ahead. They'll be talking about this more. Maybe on Monday we'll have more of those details ironed out.
You know, the idea that circumstances are sort of working to push Europe into this empire building mode is quite interesting. I think there's obviously in the European population, there are a lot of people who they don't have any interest in having an empire. And there are even a lot of the European leaders who they would be more interested in, you know, domestic issues and being good socialists and that type of thing. I would imagine that there would maybe be a few among European leaders who would have somewhat more of a mind for expanding, but I would think they would be in the minority among European leaders. At this stage, when we look at things from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, we know there's going to come a point when they're going to be far more aggressive in expanding that empire. Habakkuk even talks about a mind change taking place in a German leader where it wasn't in his heart to do this, but then he actually comes to have much more of this empire expanding mindset. Just seeing the way that these factors are lining up to almost force Europe to take more of this kind of approach, it's just interesting watching this happening. I guess in some ways you also have to look at it from the standpoint of what Gerald Flory talked about in that that whirlwind strategy. We may have even discussed this some last week, that Europe has been positioning forces throughout Northern Africa and the Middle East in ways that are maybe more long-term perspective, what it's trying to accomplish there. Any thoughts on, say, viewing things from that standpoint, from biblical prophecy, as you're watching this unfold?
Well, I think, like you said, this is where the parallels of Rome, again, are very interesting. You know, while the Roman Republic was expanding, being built, this was when most citizens would have said, we don't want an empire. We don't want to conquer other countries. Hmm. We're just being forced into this. Meanwhile, you had ambitious men, you know, Gnaeus Pompey, Julius Caesar, Sulla, people wanting, for their own interests, wanting to expand and having to paint it as self-defense. And you've kind of got the same dynamic with Europe. There is an element of self-defense. You've got Bible prophecies that talk about Daniel chapter 11, especially radical Islam. It singles out Egypt and Libya being brought under this radical Islamic king of the south. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry's talked about how Daniel 11 reveals Iran's strategy. more radical and radical Islam strategy. They're going after, it talks about Ethiopia and Egypt. They're going after control of the Red Sea. It talks about Libya. They're wanting to control the Mediterranean. You see Iran moving into Syria, threatening the Mediterranean. And that is a genuine and real direct threat to Europe. Mm-hmm. And that's something where even European citizens, if they don't want an empire, I think they'll just feel compelled. We have to get involved in these areas to keep ourselves safe. So I think you see that, you see that clash building. And so we talked about that last week. Another great area to talk about this clash, or article to read about this clash, and just all of the history in the Mediterranean, the close links between Europe and North Africa, and how that's building into this clash in North Africa and beyond between Europe and radical Islam, is Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry's article, Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III. That's from the July 2016 Trumpet print edition. So still a very recent article. It's just got a lot of fascinating history in there, even more recent history than Rome, just going back to World War II and how important the Mediterranean was there to everything going on in Europe. And it really shows why we need to be watching what is going on all the way around the Mediterranean coast.
Well, Richard, this sounds like the makings of a really good Trumpet print edition article, if you ask me. There's a lot there. I think especially just looking at some of those parallels that you're drawing to the Roman Republic era, I think that really is instructive history. And we're watching, as we have so often, with just this repetition, these cycles in European history. So thank you very much for bringing that to us. We'll look more closely now at developments in Syria, where so many of those migrants into Europe have come from. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there's a lot of things taking place in Syria and the relationships of the nations involved in the Syrian civil war right now. The first big thing that's taking place this week, it started this week, is an offensive of the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrians in southern Syria. This is an area that where we had a peace agreement between the Russians, Jordanians, and Americans to say that this area shall not be included in the fighting. This was just north of the Jordanian border and also east of the Israeli border. And that ceasefire agreement that was hammered out last year, this is one of those de-confliction zones, no longer is valid. There is severe fighting taking place there, a big offensive from the Syrian regime to try and remove this last pocket of the rebel fighters. This is really where the Syrian civil war began back in 2012, these provinces. And ever since that, for the past 6 years, you've had these areas hold out against Assad's forces. Turns out that they're going to throw away that peace deal and they're going to go in there and remove this last bit of rebellion. And this is interesting for a number of reasons. It is setting about, I think it's about 50,000 right now, Syrians putting them out of their homes. They're trying to escape this violence. So you've got 50,000 refugees trying to go across the Jordanian border. Jordan said, we've got 1 million refugees. We're closing our border. And then Israel overnight, they've sent truckloads of aid to the Syrian side of the border to try and feed these people. And so just as Richard's talking about refugees trying to escape war zones and what do we do with them, we have nations surrounding these areas that can't take them, and they're closing their borders right now. And so this is a humanitarian tragedy, really, what's taking place in southern Syria. But there are greater implications as well. Just when looking at the Syrian civil war, other events that took place this week, there was a hearing in the United States where the Secretary of State, Mr. Mike Pompeo, talked about how that we are looking, or the United States is looking for a way of removing Iran from Syria and perhaps using Putin to do this. There is a big meeting taking place just after the NATO summit in middle of July between Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin together. And we learned that one of the goals of this meeting is to try and push back against Iran inside Syria. And this is something that has a lot of prophetic implications as well. We tend to think of these players on the same side. Right now, they are fighting on the same side. But it looks like that the United States sees an opening here with Russia that could be beneficial to remove Iran from Syria.
Yeah, well, talk about the prophetic implications.
well, we know that this is eventually going to happen. Our editor-in-chief, Jerome Flory, has talked about this. He's at the very outset of the Syrian civil war. He wrote about how this was going to end. And the key takeaway, or one of the two key takeaways, was that Iran is going to be out of there. Assad, or whoever rules Syria, is no longer going to fall under the Iranian sway. And Russia might be the means to do that. You had just a lot of instances that shows that there's cracks in this alliance. One thing what else happened this week was the United States decided that it was going to say, come November 4th, I believe it is, we want all our allies to no longer receive oil from Iran. And this would hurt the Iranian economy. Obviously, they're going to lose buyers. At the same time, you had the Russians getting together with the Saudis to say that we're actually going to increase output to make up for that. And so the price, they're going to try and keep that low. So the less oil that, like, under this deal, Iran would be getting out less oil, and then they'll be getting less money for that oil. And this is the Russians that are employing this strategy. Yeah. So that, obviously, there's a crack there. And then you had, for the first time ever, really, since the Syrian civil war began and Russia was involved, a member of the Iranian parliament stand up and talk about this and how the Iranians being played by the Syrians and the Russians, and how the Syrians and the Russians, he said, they're stooges of the Americans. But this Iranian MP was saying, we're going to lose out here in Syria if we're not careful. And so we've got all these things taking place, which look to Iran's concern that it might not be so friendly with Russia, and that in the end, Russia might try and push them out of holding Syria.
It's amazing. It's an amazing confluence of developments that you're describing there. And anyone who, say, has a mind to, you know, see Iran's power limited and checked would have to be pretty optimistic looking at all of these things, not to mention the public protests that are taking place within Iran, putting additional pressure on the regime. And they're essentially saying, you know, stop funding terrorism and start taking care of us here within the nation. You know, this is where looking at things from the standpoint of Bible prophecy just gives you some sense of where this is leading in a way that you wouldn't have otherwise. You're talking about the split between the Iranian-Syrian relationship. That's something that we've been watching for a long time. Psalm 83 describes Syria as being part of a completely different confederation that Iran is not a part of. To see Russia at least having some kind of coordination of oil policy with Saudi Arabia, that's quite amazing. But to think that Iran would essentially, I guess what it comes down to is, if they're backed into a corner, what are they going to do? There's obviously a lot of pressure being put on them from a lot of different directions right now. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it is interesting because, I mean, we have this Bible prophecy talks about Iran dominating the Middle East. And we talk about that all the time. Look at Iran's gains here, 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 and here. And yet, at the same time, the Bible indicates they're actually going to lose one territory, Syria, where they are most invested right now. And so once this finally happens, I just can't wait to report this, to write about it, to just put it on the front page of the Trumpet. I'm sure our editor-in-chief will do that, because this is something. This is an analysis and a forecast we've held true to. With the ebb and flow of the Syrian civil war over the past 6 years, we've said at the end, Iran's gone.
Right. Prophecy is the only evidence. Like, yeah, it's the only the only way that you would know.
And yet, this week, we have indications of how that could actually take place.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Where would you point people to on the Trumpet to read more about this, Brent?
I would go back to that same article I referenced at the beginning, How the Syrian Crisis Will End. It's 6 years old, but that just adds to the weight of it, adds to the weight of the article because of how valid it still is.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Africa, we've been talking about in some ways. It's a region of interest not just to Europe, but also to China. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China is working to strengthen its military presence in Africa just by building up its defense engagement with African nations and also by selling more and more weapons to various African governments. On Tuesday, the Chinese kicked off the first ever China-Africa Defense and Security Forum. It's actually underway in Beijing right now. And they've got officials there from 50 of Africa's 54 countries, along with a lot of the Chinese military's top brass and other Chinese officials. And this forum will last about 2 weeks, and its purpose is just to get China more deeply integrated militarily into these African nations and to just boost military cooperation between China and these countries. And this forum is really only the latest development showing that a shift is underway in China's focus in Africa. In the past few decades, the Chinese have really focused on just all kinds of economic and commercial activity in Africa, and they're certainly not moving away from that, but now the Chinese are adding to it a military component, just partly designed to protect all of the national assets that China has in Africa, and partly to secure their supply lines and just develop deeper geopolitical influence. You know, we've spoken on the show several times about Djibouti. They're on the Horn of Africa, where China has recently opened up its first overseas military base. And now it looks like the Chinese are positioned to launch other similar bases. There's talk of one being built in Namibia. And then in Tanzania, the Chinese have just built a complex for training the local military. And, you know, it's easy to see how something like that could quickly be transformed into more of an official military base. And then with weapon sales, China has recently overtaken the U.S. with selling weapons to African nations. So there's no shortage of evidence showing that China is really working to strengthen its military presence in Africa. And this defense forum that's now underway could speed those efforts up quite a bit.
Well, this should certainly raise eyebrows among a lot of people, not least of whom would be trumpet readers who have been following what we've been saying about China's influence in Africa for quite some time. But I would think also among European leaders. Maybe you can just talk about some of the ramifications of these developments that you're describing.
Sure, yeah. What's really at issue here is just control over Africa's oil and other resources, and also some of its strategic ports and other locations. We've written on thetrumpet.com several times about Germany and the EU deepening their influence in Africa and just working to exert more and more control. Even Richard's story that we just heard about European control expanding in North Africa is part of that trend. And the story is very similar for China. So this brings to mind the Bible prophecies about the times of the Gentiles, which say that the era of America's global dominance would end and European and Asian powers would come to wield more and more control. And in Africa, you can really see that happening. You can see this prophesied Asian bloc led by Russia and China, you know, gaining more and more influence. And it's happening at a time when the U.S. is reducing its military presence in Africa. And then, of course, it's also we also see this European power exerting more and more influence there. So you can see the stage being set for competition happening between the Asian powers and the European powers for control of those resources, for control of choke points. You can see the potential for that competition and even conflict really coming into focus here.
Well, that definitely seems to be the thrust of what we've written about in the past when you're looking at the Bible prophecies of what that times of the Gentiles landscape is going to look like. This really is massive, violent conflict and competition between these major power blocks, a European and an Asian power block specifically. The competition for resources being a major part of that, it's in order to fuel empires on the scale of what the Bible describes, that they do need those resources. And for China has been making inroads into Africa for quite some time, pulling the resources out of there, investing in infrastructure to make it possible to do that, and now moving its military in order to secure those assets. It's just the next logical step in that progression. But you could see that being something that a lot of people would take exception to, or recognize that the stakes are rising rapidly. Richard, you had a comment?
Yeah, just something I think that's very interesting about this competition between Europe and China. You know, we talk at the Trumpet about how there's this prophecy that Europe and China work together for a time, and then they fall apart, and then they work against each other. And I think you can see that even in the way they work in Africa, because you will very rarely see China working with a North African country, anything north of the Sahara, or the Sahel area. And you'll very rarely see Europe doing very significant involvements south of that area. And it's almost, and then some of those areas that sit on the middle, like the Congo, you had the very first United Nations intervention force that was largely a cooperation between Germany and China. And the two of them both supplied a large number of troops to that force there that's kind of in the middle. So I do wonder whether at the moment there's some kind of informal zones of control. South Sudan was a perfect opportunity for Europe to kind of step into a country. They left it for China. So I think it's just a very interesting dynamic to watch. And you can certainly see as these powers get bigger, they get hungrier for resources, how that could lead to a clash. But at the moment, it's almost like they're kind of working together to carve out Africa to an extent.
Yeah, because just from the standpoint of ocean trade routes, China's interest is primarily in East Africa, with Xi Jinping's book on the governance of China mentioning Tanzania prominently. So you could definitely see how that'd be, as Europe's mostly looking at securing the Mediterranean. China needs to secure the Gulf of Aden and the eastern coast of Africa, which is in the sub-Saharan region.
At some point, you would imagine that those zones, that if they're agreeing to remain in separate areas right now, that's not going to remain the case.
Yeah, it really looks like there is kind of a neo-colonialism underway there right now, and eventually it very well could lead to conflict. But we have an article from our archives. It's called The Battleground, and this article just really shows how China and Europe are in competition for Africa, and just how that will eventually contribute to a third world war. And we can sort of see the stage being set for that right now.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Over to America now. Big news this week is, in some ways, perhaps the most influential justice on the Supreme Court announced that he'll retire this summer. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
It was on Wednesday, which kind of came as a surprise announcement, that Anthony Kennedy is retiring after 30 years, actually a little over 30 years on the Supreme Court. The retirement will take place on July 31st, which will give President Trump some time to consider replacements in the meantime, so that hopefully there shouldn't be too much of a gap between justices. But as you mentioned, he is, in those past 30 years, he's been called America's most important voter. In the fact that there are, especially now with judicial activism and the living constitution kind of have rising to prominence in the last half century, there have been a lot of big societal changes that have taken place, not because lawmakers voted for them, but because the Supreme Court changed a law. And with him being he's the tiebreaker vote, is that there's four progressive justices who pretty much you always know how they're going to vote, and then there's four conservative justices that you pretty much always know how they're going to vote. And then Kennedy's kind of been the one to where no one's exactly sure what philosophy he uses to come to his judicial rulings. I actually brought some a couple statistics just kind of highlighting that point about him being America's most important voter. They said over his 3 decades on the court, he's authored 276 majority opinions, 165 concurring opinions, and 100 dissents. And 92 of his majority opinions came in cases that were decided 5-4, mm-hmm. with him being the tiebreaker vote. So mm-hmm. he's had 92 cases to where his opinion has been the decisive opinion. Somewhat strangely, they said he's the only justice who's just about exactly as likely to rule with the four progressives as he is with the four conservatives. If you just look at his 2014 ruling, they said he sided with the progressive side in 8 cases and the conservative side in 5 cases. So, and then if you take a bigger picture, it's a little more down the line, 50-50. But in some of these really close cases, in 1992, he wrote the plurality decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which basically defended abortion rights across America and just reaffirmed that Roe versus Wade decision, that the federal government overrules state laws, that abortion is a right that all states have to uphold.
Mm-hmm. Which is why there are so many people concerned now that Roe v. Wade could be under threat if he's replaced by a conservative.
Right. If Roe v. Wade was challenged, it could be overturned in a 5-4 case if Chief Justice John Roberts votes for that. Mm. He's kind of the John Roberts is kind of the new de facto swing vote on the court, assuming the new justice that gets confirmed is a constitutional originalist, more in line with Clarence Thomas or Neil Gorsuch. Mm-hmm. But
so you were describing how much society has changed just because of the way that he's voting, Anthony Kennedy.
Right, because I mean, I mentioned in 1992 he had that Planned Parenthood versus Casey where he reaffirmed states' rights to abortion. In 2003, he wrote the majority decision striking down anti-sodomy laws in Texas. Mm-hmm. In 2013, he wrote the majority opinion striking down the 1996 Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Obviously, more famously in 2015, he joined the four liberal justices to form the majority in the landmark case that struck down state bans on homosexual marriage. And there's also a case that year where he upheld that housing units can discriminate against races without knowing they're discriminating against races, and outlawed that. So in matters of race, in matters of abortion, and in matters of homosexuality, he has been very transformational in what societies, especially the homosexuality thing, because now public opinion has tilted more in favor of that. But during a lot of these rulings, the majority opinion was against homosexual marriage. There was no way you were getting Congress to pass any laws legalizing this. Mm-hmm. The only way to do it was to have the Supreme Court just strong-arm this through and to basically legislate from the bench. And with four constitutional originalists taking the standpoint that the Constitution doesn't mention redefining marriage, which means from a constitutional standpoint that right reverts to the states.
Yeah.
And so it was basically Anthony Kennedy single-handedly broke that tie against public opinion.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to think about, it was Ronald Reagan who put him on the bench, and it was after the Robert Bork nomination attempt was derailed by Gerald Flory talks about this in America Under Attack, by liberals within Congress. We could have had Bork on the bench for, I don't know if he would have lasted 30 years, but I mean, what a difference it would have made. But we got Kennedy instead.
Right, because Robert Bork, he was probably the most famous constitutional originalist of the latter half of the 20th century. And now he died in 2012, which would have been before that landmark homosexuality case. Mm. But again, like I said, a lot of those, that 1992 ruling on abortion, that 2003 ruling on the anti-sodomy laws, a lot of these groundwork rulings that have led up to that landmark case would have turned out very, very differently if Robert Bork would have been on the bench instead of Anthony Kennedy, which have been Robert Bork even wrote that book Slouching Towards Gomorrah, mm-hmm. talking about like the moral decline of the United States, which in a lot of ways the Supreme Court has helped facilitate or, mm-hmm. or at least gone along with in the past 30 years, that he would have been someone standing more against.
Yeah.
Which does just make in hindsight, looking back over all those cases, that point Mr. Flory makes in America Under Attack that much more powerful, is that he's there's one sentence in particular where he goes through, there's a subhead in that book calling the demonization of Robert Bork, and he talks about, he said, the tide turned a big way in 1987. Law started to get a lot weaker, and lawlessness started to get much, much stronger. And that book, the premise of that book goes through the deeper underlying spiritual reasons because of that trend and why 1987 was such a significant year. But that is, on the political scene, the big thing that happened there is Robert Bork was attacked by and demonized by the Democratic Party at the time. He was not given the seat on the court. It was given to Anthony Kennedy instead. And then over the next 30 years, I mean, just ruling after ruling after ruling after ruling, we're just chipping away at the moral fiber of America, really, and having it slide down a slippery slope towards Gomorrah, as Robert Bork had predicted.
You're going to have to write about this, Andrew. There's a whole lot more that we could talk about. We could talk about this for another 30 minutes. We're going to have to leave it there for now. But really appreciate you bringing that to us. And we didn't even talk about what the implications of a conservative judge coming in would be. But man, there's a lot there to consider.
Well, the next month will be interesting, so there'll be plenty of time for that. So.
Right. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, the dramatic modernization of Russia's military, Europe returning to the Balkans, the royal family of Britain first traveled to Israel, and the increasingly violent nature of political discourse in America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has done a remarkable job of restoring Russia's power after it lay in ruins from the fall of the Soviet Union. One aspect of that restoration in recent years has been a dramatic and rapid modernization program for the Russian military. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Thursday, Putin said that the share of modern weapons now in the Russian armed forces has grown from just about 16% 6 years ago up to almost 60% today. So that's just a massive increase in the percentage of modern weaponry and hardware. And Putin said that they're on track now to reach their goal of having 70% of all weaponry modernized by 2021. So these were statements that Putin made at a reception in the Kremlin honoring graduates of Russia's military universities. So there's always the potential for some exaggeration in statements like these when they're geared toward a domestic and a military audience like that. But analysts agree that Russia really has made major progress in the last few years just in modernizing its weaponry. So it's a very notable achievement, especially in light of what you said, which is just how dilapidated and in what a state of disrepair the military was that Putin inherited there in the year 2000 from Boris Yeltsin. You know, during the last decade of the Soviet Union and for the first decade after its collapse, the Russian military just suffered really considerable declines. There was a lot of economic and political chaos during that time, and it all just resulted in a withering up of the funding for all of that. So when Putin came into office, the military was very weak, its equipment was badly outdated, and from the earliest years of his rule, one of his highest priorities was to transform all of that and just to modernize it. And in the last 6 years or so, all of his spending and work toward accomplishing that goal has really started to pay off. In a recent episode of the Trumpet Hour, we talked about Russia's cutting-edge Kinzhal hypersonic missile system, and that is replacing some of their archaic missile systems. We've also spoken about Russia's old Delta-class submarines being quickly replaced by the new Bori-class nuclear-powered subs, and now the Avangard intercontinental missile complexes are also coming online. And then there's just numerous other sophisticated new armaments that are replacing all the rusty old Soviet equipment. So in a very short span of time, Putin has made major gains in modernizing the military, and it's just really increasing its potential and its strength by many times. And the real significance of this, I think, is just how deeply alarmed the Europeans are by this. You know, just they see Russia's increasing power and Russia's will to use that power. They saw that in 2008 with Russia's invasion of Georgia. Of course, they saw it again right there on Europe's doorstep in 2014 with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And at that time, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury explained the significance of all that had happened in terms of Bible prophecy. And he wrote, quote, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire." End quote. So the Europeans have not forgotten what Vladimir Putin's Russia did with Georgia and with Crimea, and now they clearly see Moscow's increasing military power and its modernization, and that's a big part of the reason why we're seeing Europeans work to become more militarily unified today.
All right, wonderful job. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. One important story that Trumpet has followed for years is Europe's conquest of the Balkans. And this year has seen some prophetic developments on that front. To learn the latest, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so way back at the start of the 90s, you had Yugoslavia, a major power within that region, and a power that could very well be a strong ally of post-Soviet Russia. USSR fell, and Germany really took the opportunity to get in there and break up Yugoslavia, take it from being one kind of strong country that's a potential rival to a lot of smaller countries, the Vatican. They really brought the rest of the world around. Various different United States politicians and even UN politicians talked about the way that Germany and the Vatican did this, brought them around to siding with Croatia, breaking that apart. So they broke up the Yugoslavia, then they absorbed the bits that they kind of valued the most, that they wanted to keep, mostly Croatia, Slovakia. They're brought into the European Union, and then everything kind of stops. Europe left a lot of bits of Yugoslavia, just left them alone. They kind of had what they wanted, they broken it up, they had the pieces of real estate from that area that they were most concerned about. And bringing other countries into the European Union is expensive. Europe started running into trouble, especially in the post-2008 financial crisis. There was just no appetite to bring in more poorer countries. More recently, then you have the migrant crisis, still even less appetite to bring in poorer countries, to the point where they would eventually presumably have open borders with the rest of Europe, and you could have lots of people traveling in from the Balkans. So things kind of froze. Then Russia and China started to take advantage of that. They started, Russia kind of restarted its relationship with Serbia, drawing much closer to them. China has put a lot of money into the area. And so, like we said at the start, Europe was a couple of decades ago, until very recently even, they were fine to leave this as just kind of a blank space in the area around the Mediterranean. What they're finding now is that other empires are ready to move into those blank spaces, are already moving into those blank spaces. And so now they've been forced to take action. Just a few weeks ago, Macedonia finally resolved their name dispute with Greece, where it seems like a technical dispute. It's still very controversial and actually won't be finally solved until there's a referendum and Macedonia agrees that they're going to call themselves Northern Macedonia. But this resolution has opened the way now for Greece to drop its veto on Macedonia moving closer to NATO and closer to Europe. So Macedonia and Albania have both been, well, Europe has said that they can begin talks with these nations in 2019. And so that puts them on the timetable to join the European Union in 2025. Never been on that timetable before. So now they're holding out the European Union membership as a much more real proposition for these countries. Now, again, I think they're going to do the bare minimum they can to try and compete with Russia and compete with China. They're still not overly keen in letting in a bunch of poor countries. But now they're being forced to move much closer to these ungoverned spaces around the Mediterranean.
Remarkable job at giving us that history lesson and bringing us up to speed in less than 5 minutes. We appreciate that, Richard. I'm sure there's a lot more that you could say about this, but we will keep our eyes there on what happens in the Balkans. That Gerald Flory wrote that booklet some time ago, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, that tells all of that history. And to see Europe's response to those other empires coming in there is quite fascinating to witness. We appreciate that. Thanks for that, Richard. Relations between Britain and Israel have been pretty rough over the years, but this week, in a first for the royal family, Prince William visited Israel. Is this a sign of improved relations? For the answer, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
It is kind of stunning to just think about how Israel's been a state for 70 years. This is their 70th anniversary. And a member of the royal family has never been here on an official visit. And even though they have had some close relationships and a close relationship in many instances in the past, it is quite shocking that hasn't happened. Nevertheless, it did happen this past week with the second in line to the throne visiting Prince William. And he spent a few days both in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and then also traveling to the West Bank to meet with Palestinian officials. And so just following the reporting on this, it seems that people mostly, I would say, probably 80% very positive about this is a good sign of Israel standing in the world. Even the Brits are coming around, sending down the royal family. For the royal family to actually come down, this was something that would have been a government decision. Theresa May is a supporter of Israel, more so than previous administrations or previous governments in the UK. And so you can see why she would have wanted this. Nevertheless, Prince William did decide to come down, and Israelis are pretty rapt about it. I would say there is kind of area for just a little bit of pushback on the fact that maybe it wasn't so positive just because of the equal amount of time that he did give to the Palestinians. He felt like it was very necessary to go and sit down with Abbas. In discussions with Abbas, he talked about the two countries of the United Kingdom and the Palestinian Authority. He just meant, or Palestinian state, he mentioned them as a country, which might have been a slip up. But there was that, and then the fact that he refused to meet with the mayor of Jerusalem in Jerusalem because of the political sign that would give that I guess the UK looks at Jerusalem as being the capital of the Israeli state. That was a kind of another upsetting thing. He would have decided, he said, near Barakat, you can come and meet with us in Tel Aviv or Ramat Gan, that's just outside Tel Aviv, but I'm not going to meet you in Jerusalem. And the mayor decided, I'm sorry, I can't come because I support Jerusalem as being the capital of the Israeli state. And so there was that. And then there was also the position of the British government inside when they gave the itinerary of his visit. It talked about him visiting the Western Wall, and he talked about this being an occupied East Jerusalem, the British government did. And that is their position, that the Old City, the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, this is occupied East Jerusalem. Still to this day, we don't deem this Israeli territory. So while it's good to see, I would say that a member of the royal family did come down, there is definitely a cause for concern that this won't translate to a complete departure from Britain's antagonism towards Israel that we have seen in the past.
In 20 seconds, Brent. Prophetic context.
Well, there are a lot. 20 seconds, though. I would just go back to a really foundational book on prophecy that we talk about, the United States and Britain in prophecy, because our whole understanding of the relationship between Israel and England, or the United Kingdom, goes back to who these people are in the Bible. And we look at England as fulfilling, or as the modern type of the tribe of Ephraim, and Israel as Judah. And by understanding that, we can know where the relationship between these two countries is going to go. So please read that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy.
Thanks very much for that, Brent. We'll finish with a story about America and just how nasty political discourse is getting, even violent. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
You know, basically, in the past 2 years, political discourse and rhetoric has taken a much more violent turn, as is highlighted in three particular instances that have happened in the past couple weeks. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen was forced to leave a Mexican restaurant in Washington, D.C. on June 19th when protesters invaded the restaurant and started yelling at her. Staff members were trying to contain that situation, but members of Metro D.C.'s Democratic Socialist of America flooded the restaurant, and video footage just shows how they forced her to leave and then followed her to the next restaurant she went to. Similar incidents in Florida, where Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi was at a movie theater giving a showing of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood to children, where when she left, they had a number of left-wing activists harassing her and asking her questions about her health care policy and her stance on immigration, some even spitting on her for her support of the Trump administration's stances on both immigration and health care. And then probably the most shocking of the three, Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters actually calling for basically attacks on Trump administration officials at a rally in Los Angeles on June 24th, saying, "If you see anyone from the cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out there and create a crowd and you push back at them and you tell them you're not welcome anymore, not anywhere." And that's not the first instance of her saying that this year. Earlier in the year, she was speaking very glowingly of the 1992 Los Angeles riots as a defining moment in the way black people resisted. And longtime listeners of this show will know that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written quite a bit about the Los Angeles riots over the years, especially in his book, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, just highlighting on how those riots, which Maxine Walters has praised as such a divine moment for how black people can resist, they cost 60 lives, they cost $1 million in property damage, they cost a loss of 40,000 jobs due to rioting, and just really devastated that area back in 1992. And at the time, it was mostly radical activists doing those riots with a political establishment, politicians and things like that. Even though they didn't do much to stop it, they weren't actively endorsing it. And now that's even changing to where you've got someone who sits in the U.S. House of Representatives praising those riots, praising how members of the Trump administration being harassed in restaurants and gasoline stations and movie theaters, and calling for more people to do these types of things.
America's moving towards civil war.
Yeah, and there's a number of political commentators who've mentioned that as well. They actually took a poll recently where they said that like 30% of Americans think an actual civil war is likely. And this type of rhetoric coming from politicians, I mean, like, that sit in Congress asking for people to be harassed in gas stations and stuff like that, that is just a recipe for leading towards protest and riots in the streets that can escalate to something much more.
Which is exactly what Gerald Fleury was talking about based on the Bible's prophecies.
Right, in that Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet, he quotes prophecies in Ezekiel about one-third of the population dying in, like, urban warfare and rioting and protest. And then also references back to Ezekiel about cities burning with fire because the strangers and the foreigners and the illegal aliens within them are doing this burning. Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of the context. He's talking about the LA riots as kind of this microcosm where 60 people died. And it's like just Ezekiel's prophecy is that on a much bigger scale. And now you're even getting to the point where mainstream politicians in Congress and in the Democratic Party are not only turning a blind eye to those type of riots, but like actively calling for people to engage in them.
It's extraordinary. It's amazing to see that develop and go back and look at what Gerald Fleury said about that and look at those prophecies and realize just how grave the threat is to America's future. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and we'll provide links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to these fine gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's been an interesting show.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Abraham Lincoln. The purposes of the Almighty are perfect and must prevail, though we erring mortals may fail to accurately perceive them in advance. We must work earnestly in the best light he gives us, trusting that so working still conduces to the great ends. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.